The title of today's program is Biology Education More Than Memorizing Latin Names.
E Pluribus Unum. I think that's something on a frog. I'm not really sure.
Actually, we've got Jennifer Kraft Levy and Jung Choi from the biology department here at Georgia Tech talking about how education has changed. It's improved, right? It's more than memorizing Latin names now?
I hope so.
Are you bobbing and weaving in there? Are people having a good time?
I hope so. I don't know any Latin, so...
I think that says it all, right? If she doesn't know any Latin, but immunologists, you're an immunologist. Do immunologists have to know Latin?
No, we're just acronyms.
Oh, okay. So you're just like the electrical engineers like
that's
Bill, right? CD, critical dimension.
Yeah, I got an email from somebody that didn't buy, just throws out an acronym, and I'm going like, English, you know? English, not acronym.
I think you have that reaction even when it is English. But
yes,
we'll be talking about modern and new and exciting ways of teaching biology. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
There's always a moment, the moment you decide to get involved, to get engaged.
This is my
American story.
When you teach someone to read, they have a sense of self-fulfillment.
Seeing family, friends fall victim to gang violence, drugs, it definitely made me want to serve.
There was a hole in the ground, and by the time we left, there was a house.
I realized that these kids were not getting a meal.
It is so easy to give back.
I don't have a lot of money to help people, but I do have something. I have time.
You can give any skill you have.
I see a great need in my community.
Just imagine how strong a society we could be.
This is Barack Obama. Every one of us has a role to play in making our communities and our countries stronger. Discover yours. Help us continue to make a difference in the life of our nation. Go to serve.gov and find the opportunity that works for you. And this message is brought to you by the Corporation for National and Community Service.
Whether it's the peaceful sounds of the santur and the flute, or the intensity of the sitar and the tabla, for the highest quality of music that you'll ever hear, tune in to Gharana Music every Monday night at 8 p.m. on WREK Atlanta for an hour of Indian classical music. It will change your life.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever-effervescent co-host, a man who's not only familiar with Mr. Golgi, but his apparatus as well, Bill Hunt.
Thank you. Yeah.
I just, you realize now all our opening jokes simply need to be explained. The Golgi apparatus. Is it Golgi or Golgi?
Golgi.
Golgi. And it was a physician, Dr. Golgi. Discover this thing. I looked this up on Wikipedia, must be true.
Yeah.
And the Golgi apparatus is not a sex toy. I'm just pointing
out. Well, it does sound like something you buy at either an adult bookstore or a proctology, supply store. Either way, it's frightening.
Or in the hidden corners of Walmart. But
what does, it's an organelle in cells, in eukaryotic cells, right? So that means the more advanced type, not the prokaryotic, what are they, the lowbrow cells? What's the best way? They don't have a well-defined nucleus.
It's called poor microbe trash.
The non-trailer trash of the cellular world.
Yes.
Eukaryotic cells.
I don't know. They're just unicellular, They're not, I don't think you can, they can be just as evolved as... higher organisms.
So are you calling me a microbist?
Cool. And Bill's not very evolved, so there are a lot of single-cell organisms.
That's right.
Half cells in some cases.
But what does the Golgi apparatus do? You called it the sprinkle station, the dessert station of the cell.
That's right. So proteins, as they're getting synthesized, have some modifications that get made to them, so they get sugars added onto them, just like the sprinkles
so it does
that get
some of the glycosylation.
That's right. That's where sugars get added onto.
Well, okay. So before we continue trying to explain my bad joke in introducing Bill, let's introduce our program. Of course, it's biology education, more than memorizing Latin names. And joining us is Jennifer Levy, who basically herds the undergraduates over there, right? You teach a number of courses in the School of Biology.
That's right.
You're in charge of academic advising.
That's right.
Which is good, because it's a very alarming trend that now we're putting non-technical academic people in charge of advising. People that are professional advisors. In chemical engineering, we got a really good guy, but he's a professional advisor.
Well, but she's got a PhD in biology, right?
Absolutely. She did a PhD in immunology at Emory University. Mm-hmm. Also joining us is Jung Choi, who did his bachelor's degree in biology at MIT. We simply mentioned that because that means he's a real geek. MIT, of course, stands for Mutant in Training. That much I know. And did his PhD in biology at University of California, San Diego. And hopefully we're going to be talking... Right, and Jennifer's work is in immunology, and let me see if I get this right, the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning.
Sure.
I learned that, SOTL, I learned that acronym by looking up some of the talks that you have given recently on, you know, things like, you know, engaging students and inquiry-based learning, which is something we're all about. Jung Choi, of course, is a researcher in plant molecular genetics.
Yep.
I bet that's a conversation starter.
Cocktail parties.
I mean, you know, Bill at least does stuff with musical instruments. Me, I model some of the proteins and things like that you talk about.
How do you look in those proteins?
Not too good, I can tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not.
I've used them as cheap jokes, actually.
He's not going to be on the cover of GQ anytime soon.
I do not wear, you know, a beta barrel well.
No.
Let's put it that way. All right, but we're here today to talk about teaching biology. And I guess a lot of this got started because a lot of my students were whining and complaining. They do that a lot. I'm sure this is no reflection on the biology department.
Or you.
Because we require our students to take a college-level biology class. Mm-hmm. Do you over in electrical and computer engineering?
No need. Biology is useless.
Now, even I, as a chemical engineer, would take issue with that. I mean, the modern curriculum, you know, of chemical engineering, electrical engineering, anything that you do, even literature, communication, and culture over here, biology is so prevalent. It's so important. You cannot get away from it. So that's why we've changed our curriculum for every student in chemical engineering has to take a biology
course. But the title of your department is School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering. I actually think electrical engineering students or all engineering students would benefit greatly from coursework in biology, but we're a little bit slow on the uptake.
I've always said that about you and your colleagues, that you're slow. But fully a third of you guys do biology related.
Well, I don't know if it's that high, but I mean, I think just from my point of view, if you want to innovate and create something, biology is the greatest thing to rip off because it's just such incredible efficiency.
Yeah, I was just talking to one of our faculty members, Brian Hammer, who just got funded with some electrical engineers to look at how bacterial communication and cellular communication is similar. So, I don't know, cell phone type communication.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, of course, and in fact, we didn't give it a formal name, but we've been ripping off Mother Nature for years, right? Mm-hmm. All composite materials were stolen from Mother Nature. So I work in polymers, and the whole idea of mixing two different things with different properties, everything from crab shells to bones, they're all composite materials. And in fact, we've interviewed one of the associate directors from the Center for Biologically Inspired Design. Here at Georgia Tech.
Jeanette Yen or Mark Weisberg?
It was Mark. Thanks for remembering, because I've had eight Red Bulls. I may not make it through.
Really?
No, not eight. I've had two.
Good Lord.
I'm teaching this process design course. It's the senior design course. It's killing me.
Yeah, well, it's killing them too, I'm sure.
But here's the thing. It's tough to teach a course where you've got this open-ended problem, and people are like, well, what's the answer to that part? I'm like, I don't know. You give them the Homer Simpson answers. Actually, that's very troubling about biology. Biology is so vast and so complex. We don't know all the answers. Maybe that's one of the difficulties in teaching it. And I will say this, that when I first learned biology, it was memorizing a lot of Latin names. It wasn't doing anything active or inquiry-based
to make it stick. Yeah, but when you studied it, primates hadn't evolved yet.
This is true, absolutely. I mean, not only, were there parts of Georgia where evolution wasn't accepted yet. There were parts where evolution hasn't happened yet. All right, so what are you saying? We got a caller already?
No. If anybody wants to call in, 404-894-2468. 404-894-2468.
Well, thank you, Bill. So let's just start with the obvious question, because we don't actually have any talking points. So this will be a frenzy of activity on today's program. How are we teaching biology different than when I learned it back in the, Triassic period?
Well, I think that you can sort of compare biology to other sciences. You don't have to necessarily exclude biology as some separate thing. And I was thinking about your comment about memorization and how your students feel like they memorize. And you can do that in a lot of fields, right?
So you can do that in engineering and chemistry,
right.
Certainly.
So think about physics and how a student might go about taking a physics class memorizing formulas, right?
Right.
You could argue that you can get through physics. You could probably pass physics by memorizing a bunch of formulas and fitting things in, but you wouldn't understand the concepts of physics, right?
Agreed.
So biology is similar. I think that students who want to get by in biology and pass biology can memorize their way through some terms and pass, but to understand how the concepts interrelate is really the important part. I mean, there are very common underlying themes throughout biology, and whether you're talking about microbes or whether you're talking about large multicellular organisms in different systems, certain threads are going to be similar between all of those different concepts. And if you have memorized a bunch of terms, you're not going to understand those interrelationships. So what we've done in biology education, and this is a national issue and a national problem, and there have been a number of different reports from national organizations like National Science Foundation and AAAS that have addressed this issue. The trend is to develop those higher order critical thinking skills that are important in all sciences and all fields in biology as well, and get beyond the rote memorization and into the analytical skills that are important for developing, real scientists as they leave school.
So for the educational geeks, we're talking things at the far end of Bloom's taxonomy,
right,
about
right.
synthesizing knowledge rather than just being able to regurgitate it, which
exactly.
is on the narrow.
Well, but I mean, part of, last time I took
John, you just got to jump right in here,
yeah,
man. Otherwise,
okay,
Bill's going to
okay.
talk forever.
Right.
Yeah. But high school biology for me was 1970.
So I believe it was '05.
Yeah, it was. And,
that was only 4 years ago.
Yeah. And at that
5 years, 5 6 years ago.
I can't tell that joke anymore.
No, '05.
My life is ruined.
Yeah, I'm now 20. But I've 20 and been a professor for 25 years. It's amazing.
120, that's really what you look like.
But anyway, that was a little bit lagging by that time. DNA had been discovered and all that, but there had been, the old
Barely.
School, the old school way, I mean, it hadn't found its way into a lot of high school
sure.
biology
sure,
at that
right.
point. So it wasn't mechanistic.
So
biology was not, process oriented. It was more like, here's a frog, cut it open, we're going to have frog legs after this lab's over with.
Tastes like chicken.
Tastes a lot like chicken. But, I mean, with the preponderance of biochemistry really at the
right.
core of everything, and there seemed to be a time period there where very few biology departments actually had anybody considering anything bigger than a cell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very much process-oriented. How is this actually working as opposed to, here's a buffalo, and, they make good burgers,
You had an interesting biology class, Bill.
I've noticed in intro biology classes that a lot of students think that they can approach and do well in the course by just memorizing. I mean, that's really how they approach it, and that gets them in trouble because we've gone beyond memorization, and we're now asking them to make connections and to do analyses and do higher-level thinking. So,
As well you should. I couldn't agree more. And you're absolutely right. We try to do that in technology via engineering, chemistry, physics, math, all these sorts of things. So can you guys give me an example of how one does that?
So one thing you can do is practice it in class. So you can spend class time lecturing at students, you know, regurgitating facts from your own head and spewing them towards students. And you don't get practice in analytical thinking.
Which a dozen studies or more have said is not the most efficient or effective way of addressing this.
Right. So an example of an activity that might be done in an intro biology class or an upper level biology class would be to provide students with some raw data. So some raw data from a paper or some raw data that you've generated yourself, have them look at it, figure out how what would be the best way to present that data, try to draw conclusions from that data, maybe try to critique the variables that were used in the experiment, and think through the scientific method in class. So in that way, you're mimicking the process of science in class and helping to reinforce things that oftentimes didn't get covered or taught explicitly in biology courses.
Well, I think we've got a caller on the line here. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask you all, with the growth of elderly populations in the United States and also the growth of pollution that's a major issue in many locales, has that changed the way biology has been taught?
So let me repeat that question for the benefit of Jung, because his headphones are on the fritz. We're a quality station here. So the question is, with more old people like Bill,
and more pollution.
I added that Bill part, and more pollution, does that change the way we teach biology? For example, do we tend to use, you know, environmental stuff as an example in class?
Sure. Yeah, those are definitely issues that are major problems in biology research, right? Mm-hmm. So issues of pollution, climate change are things that we discuss in class. Mm-hmm. And, and if we were teaching a laboratory class, that might be something that students could do experiments on and projects on.
But I hope that you're not teaching the young students that, you know, you've got all these old people, you've got limited resources on Earth, so you need to kill the old people. I hope you guys aren't doing that.
We haven't
I believe that's your idea, Bill.
Yeah, but I'm inching towards the
one where they're going to... Yeah, becoming an old person myself, you know.
Yeah.
So, I will say this, that...
Chung goes in and talks about himself, and that's how we address the issue of the aging.
I do the same thing. I think,
what interests me, you know? How not to get old, right?
Back in my day, we didn't have Ziploc bags, you know, back when I was a kid. We just had wax paper.
What are those chemicals that will keep you young forever?
Yeah, where are those
coming? How will they work?
So, telomerase. So I think the answer is anything that's relevant should and is used in biology, and I think in general in education. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good point.
Yeah,
I agree with Jung. I tend to talk about what it's like getting older because you have a relevant example. I mean, I was talking to middle school kids about scaling laws in math, and I explained that, look, you know, when my son was about 7 years old, he was half my height, half my width. Okay, maybe not quite half my width because I have a different aspect ratio than he does. You know, and half the depth. So if you want to figure out what our approximate volumes and weights are, assuming a similar density, I'm 2 to the 3rd times bigger than he is, but my kneecaps are only 2 squared larger than his.
Yeah.
So it's this whole volume to surface area ratio. And that's why I don't go crawling in the tubes at Chuck E. Cheese anymore, right? That's why, the biggest animal that ever lived was a marine animal, not a land animal, for that reason. It's a whole buoyancy mass.
Did you ever go crawling in the tubes
at
Chuck E.
Cheese? Yeah, when I was younger, I did. I went in the ball crawl.
Okay.
What does that have to do with...
Well, because put about
anything, the tubes and Chuck E. Cheese.
The area of your kneecap, as I increase my dimension relative to my son, the area of my kneecap goes up as that volume, as that dimension increases squared, whereas my mass goes up as the that dimension cubed.
Yeah.
So my mass is going up faster than the cross-sectional area of bones and kneecaps to support it. So actually, if you take...
So you think the tube's going to break?
No. My knees are going to ache.
Your knees are going to ache.
Yeah, and I'm going to be in pain. Well, think about it.
Kneecaps are going to get worn down.
Yeah, I mean, babies crawl across floors all the time, but grown-ups don't. Unless we go, you know, we complain about our knees.
No, it's the tequila factor.
I was trying to bring in an old person joke there. That's what I'm saying.
No, but I mean, you know, you know, it seems so much more process. Or when do you think that kind of took over at the earliest level? I mean, when did biology departments become so strictly biochemical? And you guys have any? And when did that trickle in?
But I don't think they're. You make our biology department sound like it's all biochemical.
Not ours. But I mean, a lot of biology departments, it's been nothing bigger than a cell.
No, I think chemistry department spawned off the biochemistry part.
Right.
Well, I mean, the era of molecular biology was really kind of the last half of the last century, right? So as, you know, when DNA was discovered and discovered to be what was containing genetic information.
So many people
everybody was working out.
Right.
And it was really an amazing, I mean, I was talking about this with my students a few weeks ago about how we don't celebrate, you know, Hershey Chase Day, but we should. We should be really excited
Hershey Chase?
So the Hershey Chase experiment is one of the hallmark experiments that demonstrated that DNA contained heritable information, right? That you could transform bacteria with phage DNA. You could transmit a
phage
trait.
Phage contains DNA as their genetic material.
I mean, I'm still back on the what is it, the Miller-Urey experiment, so I'm a ways behind.
Well, that's way on back there. That's different
back
idea.
Back in the 50s.
But,
actually, Carl Sagan
this is all way back.
Student at the University of Chicago at that time.
Yeah. I mean, they're just addressed different issues. But, you know, I was trying to think, what were Americans doing when these experiments came out and not paying attention to them? Like, what were Americans doing instead of paying attention to...
So whom was Hershey Chase? So
buying cars, having babies.
Watching TV when TV came out, is right. Early 60s.
Early 60s? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, they were buying gas for 29 cents a gallon, I can tell you that.
And riding on Route 66. So, right, of course, why would they be paying attention to these really explosive, incredible advances in biology that occurred at this time?
But I think one thing we found on this program is they're not going to pay attention to it, right? It's a fundamental thing. And we've skipped our science in the news. We'll save it for next week. But it was basically talking about these melanoma treatments that have represented major fundamental breakthroughs in the science and the immunology and understanding the mechanism behind cancer. But to prolong your life a few months, it's $120,000. So it may not have the most practical application yet.
Well, it depends on what you're going to do with that 2 or 3 months.
That's right.
I think I'd just, I think I'd drink a lot of scotch to kill the pain and last another month and live with it. That's what I'm thinking. But that's just me, though, Bill.
It's nice to know you have a plan, though.
No, but the point is, I mean, sometimes I think we're arrogant to think all these major breakthroughs that people are going to pay attention to it. And they're not going to pay attention to it. We're all excited about it. But the reason they should pay attention to it is now that idea is so prevalent in everything that happens throughout their day, it's not even funny. I mean, maybe you're right. You have to wait for maybe the polymerase chain reaction or something that's a more practical application of that idea.
I don't think so.
I think part of the problem is with the media in that when they report something, they want to say, this is a breakthrough, everything's already done, and science is actually, and engineering too, is a plodding process. I mean, this experiment that Hershey Chase did back in the early 60s, probably to a very small group, said, wow, this is really breakthrough stuff, but somebody that was doing plant biology was like, I want a Hershey, but I don't want to get chased. What do I do now?
Hello, Gregor Mendel. It did kind of explain all the plant biology that we did. But Bill, we're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
When we come back, we're going to learn why we don't celebrate Hershey Chase Day here on Inside the Black Box.
You're leaving me?
Science only
You're
funny.
Leaving me. He's...
In the last decade, more than 400,000 people died on America's roadways. That's one person every 13 minutes. Since 1969, the American Traffic Safety Services Association has worked to make our roadways safer by providing safety devices, including bright signs and pavement markings, guardrails, and crash cushions. Most American roadways were built in the 1950s, so much more needs to be done to reach the ultimate goal of zero deaths. Safer roads save lives. Learn more at ATSSA.com, a public service from the American Traffic Safety Services Association.
Ladies and gentlemen of Georgia Tech, July 24th from 7 to 9 p.m., WREK Atlanta presents Chunklet Radio. Be prepared to hear the crappiest crap from one of the crappiest magazines in Georgia. Hear the Pagans, the Mirrors, Teenage Panzer Corps, and a bunch of other stuff. That's from 7 to 9 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, July 24th. Be there.
All right, we are back on Inside the Black Box with Jennifer Kraft Levy and Jung Choi talking about the new ways that we are educating students.
And so, if you want to call, it's 404-894-2468.
That's especially if you're listening live Wednesdays noon to 1. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468.
And I can't do my, if you're dead, don't call.
Call in anyway.
Yeah,
let's
call
go for
in
broke.
Anyway if you're dead.
Why not?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
So what about lab classes?
Right. We were talking about dissecting a frog earlier, mm-hmm. right? Bill
yeah.
was talking
yeah.
about the frog dissection. And the trend
don't
in bio. No.
Yeah, that's
we didn't,
not a good lab experiment, actually.
No, yeah. So dissections are descriptive. So, you know, you open up an animal, you can look at where the organs are, but what kind of question are you asking? Do you have a hypothesis? You know, what are your controls? There, you know, you're not really doing an experiment in that case. And labs can be demonstrative, they can illustrate concepts that you're talking about in class. Or they can teach the process of science, and that's really, you know, inquiry and doing real valid experiments and having students think of hypotheses and design experiments with the appropriate controls and collect data and analyze it and communicate it. Those are all things that are important in being a scientist and understanding new research and new science that's coming out. And so in our lab courses, we have moved, you know, entirely away from cookbook-style labs. They call them cookbook-style labs, where you're given a protocol and you just kind of go through step-by-step.
Yeah, where you know what the answer, what the right answer is supposed to be.
Right.
Or you think you know.
Right. And I think a lot of students, you know, in years past have gotten turned off by research and turned off by lab courses because they don't get, especially in biology, you don't get the result that you're expecting.
Right.
So the experiment didn't work and they get all sad and frustrated. But, you know, when you're doing real research, you often don't get the experiment that you're expecting. And to be able to explain that and move on and design your next experiment is what we're trying to teach.
All right.
Plus,
all right.
I mean, the science, the biology has, you know, especially the molecular biology has gotten so cool and we can do so much that even undergraduate students can now do PCR experiments. They can actually do gene splicing. And, you know, that's what we do. I mean, we want students to be able to do these things and really participate in just the cool biology.
We have another caller. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Do you have a question or comment for us?
Yes, I just wanted to comment on how biology has changed, how it's being taught differently from the way it initially was. I taught biology a couple of years ago in public school, and what was really revolutionary to me was the technology. Nowadays, we have what's called Promethean boards or smart boards. Some counties call them that, and I just know when I taught the cell, and I was trying to explain mitochondria, you can just go to a cell and see mitochondria and compare a liver cell to a heart cell or something, and it just illuminates what you're trying to bring forth in the lesson, which is very different from when I was in high school eons ago, and, you know, you had a picture in a book, that was pretty much it.
Right.
think they can really grasp concepts better because of the technology that's available in the bigger school systems, I'll say, now.
Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is the ability to grab right off the computer, the internet, you know, a whole variety of different, you know, types of phenotypes and genotypes.
Are you talking about actual cells, though?
Or are you talking about actual cells?
I'm sorry, say it again.
So in these experiments, I don't know anything about a Prometheus board. I barely know about Prometheus, but...
these are smart boards. Your kids have them in their classrooms, trust me.
They're projectors.
So being able to...
It's like a huge computer screen.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. So, an old blackboard. Yeah. Okay, so if somebody has prepared something showing cells dividing or whatever, mm-hmm. it's all right there and you could see it. Okay. Yeah,
that's a really great point is how technology is going to change and is changing the way we teach all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But especially biology, we were talking about processes and how biology has become process-oriented.
Right.
I mean, it's really, we now have really cool animations showing the biological processes, and these are scientifically based. They're all data-driven. They take these molecular structures that scientists have worked out, and these molecular animators use these molecular structures to produce molecular visualizations and animations that I really love to use in class.
You're in the cell.
Yeah.
The Golgi apparatus is right there next to you.
So that's a great point. Technology is making a big difference, too. Yeah, thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And the stuff you're talking about, you can find on YouTube. And it's all
Absolutely.
Over the place. In fact, the Golgi apparatus had a ribosomal...
Golgi.
Yeah. Because I went to the endoplasmic reticulum and the ribosome, and it was showing all the different sorts of stuff where in the old days, you're right, it was just either some really badly stained cell or who's the guy? Irving Geist did a lot of this for biomolecules, right? And right over in the IBB building, the Institute for Bioscience and Bioengineering, we have a lot of Irving Geist's.
He was an artist.
He was an artist who drew some wonderful pictures of biological macromolecules and things like that. I don't know if he was, but he's given us a lot of his paintings. Oh, really? His estate has. They were nice enough to do that. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever taken biochemistry, you have seen some of his illustrations. And they were wonderful, but now when it can move and do it in a mechanistically realistic fashion to show you the, I like that, glycosylation is the sprinkle table of the whole thing, then it makes a huge difference. It makes it so much easier to understand, I think. But what you were talking about before is, this is very good, and I agree with you. I think every area is trying to do this. Get away from these descriptive labs where cut the frog open, look for the aorta, look for the liver, remove the spleen. No, do frogs even have spleens?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes, sure.
That tells you what I know about biology. I barely know, you know, Dr. Golgi. As opposed to now, it's like, you know, you're investigating something. You don't know the answer, right? So what's it? Can you give me an example of these more demonstrative or investigation-based sort of things? It's like, here's a frog. Is your frog, you know, genetically different than the other frog? Things like that.
Well, I mean, you could. So say you were interested in looking at the effects of pollution on the growth of something. So
So it's timely based on what our first caller asked.
Right. Yeah. So say you wanted to see, you know, what the effects of various components of fertilizer have on the growth of, you know, a common plant that grows in ponds, duckweed.
Okay.
This is one of the experiments that we've done in our introductory labs in the past. So the students would say, well, you know, we think the phosphorus is going to positively impact the growth of these plants, and then they'll, you know, maybe come up with a dose of phosphorus and treat plants with different concentrations of phosphorus and measure the growth. And so instead of just demonstrating that phosphorus is important for growth of plants or talking about it in class, they have actually, you know, designed experiments to show that varying the levels of phosphorus in the growth media of these plants changes how well they grow.
And the question is, hopefully they pick a range that's broad enough, right? Because if it's a teeny weeny range, then you see you know, barely an effect. And the question is, if you use too much, does it have a deleterious effect? Is there an optimum?
Right.
Is the amount of phosphorus that goes in your lawn fertilizer, which is a number you can read off the bag at Home Depot,
right,
higher than what will be good for when it leaks into the pond next to your lawn.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's part of good experimental design. Okay. And that's one of the skills that we want to teach is how, you know, once you have a hypothesis, how do you properly set up an experiment to be able to test it in a valid way?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think that's great. So that's it. We answered everything. Modern technology and demonstrative experiments.
Right. So there's all kinds of technological advances in the classroom, too, that are changing the way things are taught. So we use clickers in class, which are like on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, when you ask the audience.
Right. So the personal response systems.
Right. Yeah. The personal response
And you guys call
system.
Them clickers? We call them clickers, too.
Clickers.
Nobody knows what I'm talking about.
Clickers. Yeah. So each student has their own clicker, and you'd ask them a multiple choice question and poll them, and then get immediate feedback. You'd have a bar graph pop up with what percentage of your students think each of the answers are correct or incorrect. Mm-hmm. And that's called formative assessment and education speak. You have instant assessment of where your students are in terms of learning a particular concept.
Right.
And so you're using technology to get that formative assessment, but it's important in a class that's, 300 students. You can't ask each person.
Right.
But I think this is interesting because, there are so many different learning styles, that people go through. And if you can, in my opinion, if you can experience something, you've got a shot at really grasping it and understanding it. And, some of the technology, let's just say PowerPoint, I've noticed, I don't lecture with PowerPoint anymore. Everybody's pencil goes down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're not
like
interactive. They're not interactive.
And they're expecting you to post the PowerPoint slides on the web.
Right. Yeah. And I had this is a bit extreme, but I had a professor at Illinois that you'd have a weekly problem set, and he wouldn't give you the solutions. Mm-hmm. He posted it outside his office, and you had to go write it down.
Right.
To drill home. I never went over there, but,
So obviously it didn't work for you, Bill.
I did okay in the class, but but what I'm saying was he wasn't giving it out because if you go over and you're just the process of copying it down, you're learning something. And I think some of the technology, that gets the clicker thing, gets them involved. Mm-hmm. They're participating in a class of 300, which is very difficult to do because, only the psychotic would raise their hand in a class of 300.
Right.
And you don't really want to hear from those people. But,
there was a day when the smart guy used to raise their hand. Is that no longer the case? Or
the smart girls raise their hand sometimes.
Yeah. Or the smart girl.
Yeah. But 300, you got a lot of people that have an opinion, but they're not going to say.
Sure.
Or even actually when the class size gets above about 30, you got a lot of people clamming up at that point.
But if the people who always know the answer are raising their hand, you feel like the class understands.
Right, but it's just maybe, that one person.
Yes, exactly. Right. It could be five people in the class who get it and 95% don't.
Right.
So. And that was the gender-neutral guy, I was saying. So let me ask you a question about biology, because ironically...
Ken was gender-neutral.
The ratio is good? Is that what you're going to say?
No, is the ratio good?
Yeah.
Is the ratio bad?
It's
what
best.
Is the ratio?
I mean, if Georgia Tech wanted to increase the ratio, they should just... expand biology is all I've got to say.
So are you guys, what, 60%?
Yeah, we're like 60s. Yeah, 65.
Okay. Maybe even 70%.
Maybe even 70%. The ratio is good in bio.
Well, see, that's an interesting side question is there are not nearly as many women in electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm. I think that's because of you, Bill. I'm going on a limb here, but that's my theory and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, I'd kind of run a lot of people off. But... and I personally don't think it's because electrical engineering is so math intensive. I think it's such a solitary pursuit. I mean, you're
making them sound like losers here. I mean,
losers, just solitary. You're working.
Hold up in their room playing Halo Reach.
Yeah. Well, that's only when they're having fun and then they're socializing online. But no, I mean, you don't have a lot of team oriented things electrical engineering. You do at the end of it, but I mean, I think that's part of it. It's such an isolated. It's like detective novels. It's usually a dude that has no friends and goes and catches people. That's kind of the prototypical. I mean, there are female detectives in novels and things like that. We have another caller? Okay.
Well, I mean, so there's two issues there, I think. One is, I think the sorts of things you guys are describing, this demonstrative lab stuff, is something that is general. We try to do that in chemical engineering, and certainly, regardless of what Bill says, you do it with your musical demonstrations mm-hmm. of frequency distributions and things yeah. like that. But a lot of the gender bias people attribute to a number of studies that came out, now it's more than a decade ago, that claim that women enjoy professions where they see themselves having direct positive impact on society. Biology is right. that way. Bioengineering is that way. Right. Chemistry, 51% of the students at Georgia Tech the undergraduate students at Georgia Tech are women. Chemical engineering is between 35 and about 42% women. We are the highest in engineering. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's maybe that chemistry, we also have the biomolecular mm-hmm. angle as well. Mm-hmm. So that's changing a lot. So I still blame you for the whole electrical engineering thing.
Well, I mean, you know, part of it is, I mean, there are definite gender differences, and I think it has to do with women want to be contributors, and we're happy to kill somebody, you know, like, oh, we get to kill somebody with this missile. Excellent. I mean,
yeah, you're going old school. I see what you're saying here.
No, but I mean, men
are worthless. Women have an altruistic view.
I don't know. Some of it comes from, you know, even further back. So if you asked your average Georgia Tech electrical engineer, when did you know that you wanted to go into engineering, electrical engineering, mm-hmm. what would their answer be?
I have no idea. I don't ask that.
You don't know?
No.
Come
no.
on.
No, no, no.
Come
I don't. On. No, I don't know. I'm not avoiding the question. I don't know.
There are a lot of things Bill doesn't know.
Right.
Yeah, I would say a lot of them figured that out in middle school or high school when they started messing with, you know,
right.
in our day it was the crystal radio set, mm-hmm. but now mm-hmm. it's the, you know, more advanced electronic type kits and take it apart your cell phone or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But my daughter, who I'm hoping to get in right. to talk to you at some point, she knew she wanted to be in biology when she was in middle school. She was just fascinated with it. And she's not sure where she wants to go, but she knows she likes biology and not yeah. chemistry or chemical engineering.
Well, I think a lot of the programs that reach out to younger students, you know, are going to be effective in recruiting women into fields like the Lego robotics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the ratio of boys to girls in Lego robotics programs, but I bet there are a number of girls that are interested in those types mm-hmm. of programs, and then they can get exposed to the field earlier on.
It's substantially.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's still not as high as you'd like it to be, but it
right.
has improved substantially.
But I you know, let me sound even more Tea Party-ish, but I mean, I think we ought to be encouraging everybody, give them the opportunity to be exposed to biology, engineering, whatever, and not worry so much about gender and who's getting in. I think we want a culture where we're not going, oh, women can't do this or women can't do that, which I don't believe. But we, you know, we shouldn't be pushing people or just focusing on young girls. Or, I mean, I've got three high school students doing internship in my lab this summer in musical acoustics. They're all musicians.
Mm-hmm.
They all happen to be guys. But, I mean, I taught them calculus last
week. I think that's because women in general, and this goes for your wife as well, are afraid of you, Bill. So hold that thought, Bill, because
okay,
we've got
thanks.
To take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the more biology-specific aspects of education here on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
We once told an old farmer to tune into the Back Alley Pork Cruise for the best of country, bluegrass, folk, and American traditional music. And here's a friend, Bascom Lamar Lunsford, with the rest of the story.
The old farmer gets excited and he said, "That beats anything I've ever seen. Come here, old woman. Boy, take that man's horse out there and put him in the crib and stop the door of the fodder stack. Beats anything I've ever heard. Here, put some pumpkins in the trough. Stranger, I wish you'd teach me the other part of that tune. Say, old woman, wish you'd knock the iron wedge in the head, and we'll have brains for supper."
Once again, that's the Back Alley Pork Roost. Every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m., tune in to hear the best of country, bluegrass, folk, and American traditional, right here on your home for quality diverse music, WREK Atlanta.
Start your Friday off right? Look no further than Coffee and Sushi, airing every Thursday night, Friday morning from midnight to 1, right here on REC, I'll be mixing chill out, lounge, down tempo, and just about all kinds of smooth, ice cold grooves. Every edition delivers fresh tracks from one of the most overlooked genres in music. Check out the most recent playlist at wrk.org/coffeeandsushi. Your soul with Coffee and Sushi every Thursday night, Friday morning at midnight, right here on 91.1 FM WREK. Elevate your soul.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're chatting with Jennifer Kraft Levy and Jung Choi from the School of Biology, here at the Georgia Institute of Technology, about new teaching approaches in teaching biology. So all the stuff that you're talking about, getting people to the point where they don't just repeat the dissecting of the mouse or the frog or the whatever it is, and they move into, you've got to design the experiment, you've got to figure out what hypothesis you want to look at, how to tease that. And I use the word tease because it's a very tricky thing. Tease that out of the data and figure out what your appropriate conclusion are. You know, the technology, which one of our listeners brought up, you know, the diversity of biology makes it so much nicer rather than just having that little black and white figure in these old textbooks. You know, mm-hmm. these old scaling laws books about elephants versus fleas, and you see it on a log mm-hmm. graph. Now you can go look
at
examples.
That's still in the book. That's still in there.
Absolutely. But so all those are helpful to any area, chemistry, engineering, any area of science. Is there anything specific to biology that presents a challenge or an opportunity or, you know, for example, controversies about the origin and nature of life? Does that throw you for a loop? Because it certainly does at the high school level, and we'd had several guests discuss that.
Okay, so I'm so glad you asked that question. About 10 years ago, we... in biology made a conscious decision that we were going to lead off our introductory biology course with a module on evolution, where we spend about 3 weeks talking about evolutionary theory and the evidence for evolution and how that applies to essentially all of biology. A lot of people think, as we were discussing earlier, that biology is just a lot of disconnected facts that you just have to memorize. There's no connections between stuff. But evolution is what connects all of life on Earth. And we think that evolution has lots of explanatory power. It's the fundamental law of biology, like Newton's three laws. Biology has evolution. So we now lead off intro biology with evolution. And I think it has worked really well because mm-hmm. now we can... discuss molecular biology, cell biology, ecology, even things like immunology mm-hmm. from the context of evolution.
Right. So that makes perfect sense to me. In fact, I've never quite heard it put that way. It's the fundamental law of biology, like force equals mass times acceleration in physics. Does that make it more palatable to the typical student? Because I think people sort of think of Darwin milling about in the Galapagos finding finches. And let's face it, Darwin was very brilliant to see the pattern and very lucky to put it all together. But what explains it, the driving force behind it and how it applies not just to finches but to molecules and everything in between, was not understood till many, many, many years later. Now that we have that understanding, right? And you mentioned before, you do polymerase chain reaction, you know, where you can amplify DNA and look at it, right?
Sure.
Will they do gels of DNA?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, and you point out this is the same thing the crime lab does?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And relate it to, so it's just like, it's like CSI, but they're just better looking than we are. Have you ever noticed that? They only have beautiful people on those shows?
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's my big complaint.
Right.
So do you ever get any pushback from that, though?
Yes. So occasionally a student will come and want to talk to me about evolution. And
you tell them there is no God, and then
no, absolutely not.
Right. Okay, so that's what Bill would do. He's a very nurturing individual.
Yeah. First, crack him over the head with a baseball bat, and then let's talk about learning science.
We talk about the fact that people like Francis Collins, who's the director of the Human Genome Project, he's a devout Catholic and has published a couple of books on how he feels that genomics and evolutionary biology is completely compatible and even affirms his faith.
And he's hoping someday there'll be a genetically engineered pope.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. We've got a caller on the line. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, I was wondering if you, as educators, were familiar with a book that came out recently called Nurture Shock.
No, was it I don't.
Nurture Shock,
Nurture
you
Shock?
Said?
Mm-mm.
No.
Yeah.
No. What's Nurture Shock about?
Educating young people and some of the theories they had about educating, bringing up young students. They mentioned the Gwinnett County school system is one of the biggest, top 20 biggest school systems in the country, and some of the programs that they had with accelerated programs for the kids, and that how they tested in it early because they have environmental conditions, and then when they test them a little later in life in junior high or middle school, that they were getting different results because the kids were learning a different method. The mind was working a little differently.
So what's the method behind this Nurture Shock ideology?
Well, it was a couple journalists who just had gathered some data on what they found when they looked back at some of the methods that they've been using in the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at what was working. I'm in favor of electroshock therapy for teenagers. By the way.
in the 60s, it was kind of let the nurturing or the parent style was just let them go and let them learn at their own pace and everything.
And
yeah, when things didn't go right, pull the belt off.
Self-paced learning. It had good sides to it, but it wasn't always great for everyone that wasn't self-motivated, mm-hmm. like me, for example. Mm-hmm. But Nurture Shock sounds like you put him in an office with Bill.
I think the thing is when you nurture them too much, you're cutting off their ability to examine the world.
Yeah,
right.
There is a balance.
It looked at a lot of different things, but
that'd be a good thing to look at. We should try to get the author of that one.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. We'll have to take a look at it.
Yeah. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, thanks.
And we have another one. Yes, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is, how often are biologists used in expert witnesses for trials? There's a lot of mining issues in Kentucky and West Virginia and Tennessee about the pollution of water wells and streams. And do biologists get asked to testify in court on one side or the other for specific bullets here?
That's a great suggestion.
When you asked if how frequently they were used, I thought you meant as experimenting on biologists.
to testify.
Yeah,
here's some
toxic stuff. Let us know how you feel.
Let me add to that. Can those cases be used as a teaching tool?
Absolutely. Yeah. So actually, I do. I have done a lot of expert witness testimony for forensic analyses of DNA. I'm also aware of colleagues who have in the ecology and environmental field who testify as expert witnesses in those areas.
Do you ever use those?
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I realize you can't use the ones that you've testified on because you're often prohibited from doing that. But one of the things that I learned in working with my colleagues, Matthew Ralph, is that students like things that are relevant. It was actually Tom Morley, another collaborator that worked with us, that pointed this out. So if you sort of give them some data analyze, you can give them some Drosophila genetics data from a paper, or you can give them something quite relevant to what they do, you know, childhood obesity. You know, pick high school students, right, because they were recently a high school student. And have them correlate that with where they live, how much Krispy Kreme they eat, this sort of stuff. And then maybe look at, you know, amount of carbohydrates in those foods, all that sort of stuff. That's really good stuff. And I would think court cases would be as well.
Oh, absolutely. Especially the CSI DNA stuff. I actually took some of the evidentiary material, changed the circumstances, changed the names, and I've given them out to high school teachers and used them in my own classes.
Oh, wow. So these were actual cases, but you just sort of generically took the numbers. Right. So no one could trace it back then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So
that's
so
a
that
good.
Is
that's,
cool.
That's a good. I like that because it's using what's there, and then the deductive reasoning is about other facts, whereas you really don't want them you know, here, genetically modify your cat, you know, so that it actually likes your father as opposed to the cat
that
we
have.
No,
it creates a desire for them to know, you know, what is this actual, what are these bands that they're seeing, you know,
how, they
how
really
does this
do it.
Work,
yeah.
And,
right.
you know, and if you get a positive result, what does it actually mean? And so I can tie in population genetics, genetic variation,
what's the probability of
statistics.
False alarm and that kind of
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a, mm-hmm. a wonderful way to integrate a lot of subjects.
No. So now we're getting into sort of the populist version of this mm-hmm. sort of stuff that, you know, granted, PCR and looking at gels of DNA, that's core genetic science, but do students get more interesting in it if you can relate it to crime scene investigators, if you can relate it to SpongeBob SquarePants, I don't know, something like that?
I think it depends on the class.
Okay.
So here at Georgia Tech, our intro biology population has a few different populations within it. So we have some okay. students who are going on to med school, and they are very, very serious about what they want to be learning in introductory biology. It's going to be on the MCAT. They have very, very defined ideas of what they want to take out of it. But it's also a course that satisfies our general lab requirement on campus. So we have non-majors, you know, from Ivan Allen and from management
and
people
even from
so
that's the
business even from
school,
EE, yes, yeah. who are taking mm-hmm. it because they're interested in the topic.
Right.
And so in that case, some of those students aren't going to get as engaged by, you know, with by the latest
application
and, oh, okay. and are going to be more interested in, you know, something you can pull off of TV or
okay.
or from the popular media. So,
and are we selling out because we get a little populist? And
I don't, if you keep the science good, I don't think you are.
Yeah, I don't think we are as well. I think any rule goes. If you can do anything, I mean, you know, Bill and I, we try to do mm-hmm. funny, I do funny examples in class. In fact, mm-hmm. I have them do a very advanced statistics lab, and I'm going to borrow something from my colleagues who did the introductory chemical engineering class. I'm going to have them swell gummy bears and try to predict what the average molecular weight between cross links are and things like that. We've noticed that the color of the gummy bear correlates with how much it swells, which it shouldn't. There's something funny going on there, and I want my students to know.
Red dye number two.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. So you're going to swell gummy bears or do something relevant to mm-hmm. CSI. One of our colleagues, Larry Bottomley, back when there was a lot of lead in products from China, literally brought a bunch of imported products and gave it to his analytical chemistry students and said, find me the lead. That was it.
Wow.
Yeah. So that is cool.
Yeah, I would submit that the EE students are only in the biology class to meet the girls that are going to look like the ones on CSI.
Right.
There aren't a lot of girls in electrical engineering. We should address that. There should be. Women do electrical engineering just as well, if not better, than any guy.
Well, yeah,
why aren't they there?
Yeah,
aside from you.
Bill. Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with a lack of skill. I think it's that the culture of electrical engineering is very solitary.
Wow. This does not bode well for electrical engineers.
We're going to die out. We keep procreating, but, you know.
I want to thank Jennifer for just being very professional here, very, very to the point. No, I'm just saying,
she is
the wackiest among the advisors.
She never ate on air. We didn't hear any.
No,
that was professional.
She's only halfway through her professional chicken sandwich.
Can't say you would do. If you had pizza, it'd be all over the microphone by now.
But you wouldn't know she plays guitar in an all-girl. Is a country band now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just
saying. Which one?
The Bare Knuckle Betties.
Oh, okay.
They
all
are
right.
Really cool. That's that's just my opinion. I just, you know.
Yeah, that's neat.
And I think that's certainly good. It helps you relate to the students. All right, so we've reached the end of the program, and the portion of the program I like to call What Have We Learned? And it's been a lot. First of all, don't badmouth prokaryotic cells. That's really what I learned.
No.
In the evolutionary scale, they may be more advanced than Bill. That's basically what we learned today. And that biology and whatever techniques we're using to change the way we teach it is no different than any other science and technology. That what we need to do is trend toward higher order critical thinking, right? Mm-hmm. So if you ever look at Bloom's taxonomy, there's the base level is you memorize some facts and you memorize a few concepts or some Latin names like I learned biology. And then you move up the scale on how to use and manipulate and ultimately synthesize new knowledge from your observations. Mm-hmm. And that's really the whole approach that is taken by these more demonstrative labs where you actually
inquiry labs. Yeah.
Okay, where did I get demonstrative here?
I don't know.
So more of an inquiry-based lab where you have to formulate the hypothesis and worry about how you're going to tease the conclusion out of the data and what the conclusion is, as opposed to what we used to call the cookbook ones, the descriptive ones. And we are trying to move away from that in chemical engineering as well. Most of them are gone, but we do have some of those that as well. We also jumped right in the middle of the controversy of why we don't celebrate Hershey Chase Day, which, of course, was the first experiment to point out that DNA does, in fact, carry
one of the experiments that information.
It was the sort of the nail in the coffin.
The nail in the coffin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. It really nailed down that DNA is the hereditary material.
Okay. Yes. And that's maybe really just one of the pivotal moments of pointing out that now, and this is something new to me, that evolution is not only considered but is taught as here at Georgia Tech the fundamental law of biology. Mm-hmm. Right. And the point is, we have so much evidence now and so much information on it that rather than speculating on it, you know, a century ago, it is a fundamental law. There's a lot to back that up. And you use it as the basis for teaching everything from literally genetics, immunology, macromolecular, protein evolution, that sort of stuff.
Right.
One big advantage, and I think this is particularly beneficial in biology because biology is so diverse. Right, that there is no one example of an osteoblast, right? There are lots of them. And in the old days, we looked at one black and white photo in a textbook, and that's really what you had, and you had one animation of it. Now you can go out on the web, throw it up on a smart board, and that was a good suggestion that one of our callers pointed out, and show all sorts of different examples.
Sure.
So I think that definitely affects things in biology in a particularly useful way. Formative assessment is what Jennifer called it, and the whole clicker thing, I think, is useful to anyone for me to figure out whether or not I'm getting through them as well. We use them in our classes, but I would think this whole fundamental nature of biology would make an interesting survey in there. I mean, when you start teaching evolution as the fundamental law of biology, do you ask people what they think of as evolution?
Yeah.
Okay, because, I mean, that gets a little different. You don't have to ask people, do you believe in Ampere's law? You know, it's irrelevant. And actually, it's irrelevant in evolution as well. It's not something you believe in, but modern society has maybe made it that way. So
I don't ask whether they believe in evolution.
Right.
I ask, you know, what does evolutionary theory predict? Okay,
right.
What is the evidence that supports it?
And a whole lot of stuff, I think, is the answer now. So we did find out that Bill is holding out for a genetically engineered pope.
Yeah.
You do realize the pope is changing the Pope-mobile to a hybrid. So he's
solar power, I think.
Or was it solar power?
Solar power?
I thought it was at least a hybrid.
He also got an iPad and actually sent out his first tweet a couple days ago.
Yes, he is on Twitter.
Are you
he's
serious?
On Twitter,
yes.
And he wants to upgrade the Pope-mobile. So so there you go. So I think the genetically engineered Pope is just around the corner.
Just around the corner. Yeah.
Wow. Right. I think genetically engineered Pope's a great idea.
All right. See, I thought Hershey Chase Day had something to do with chocolate, so I was really educated there as well.
We also
learned that you have to use what you can to teach students about biology, because you've got our chemical engineering students who are complaining about having to take it, even though it's very important. We learned that med students are still uptight.
They always will be. Yeah.
Right. And we got a great suggestion for something we might want to look at in a future program. Nurture Shock. Sounds like an office hour session with Bill.
Right.
Which is being used right here in Georgia in Gwinnett County as a suggestion from one of our listeners.
That's why I keep a taser in my office, but go ahead.
You are a nurturing individual. I've always said that. What have we left out? Anything we've left out?
No, this is great. Thank you guys so much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Jennifer Jung, thank you so much for joining us. And if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion.
Oh, thanks for all the callers, the very intelligent Inside the Black Box callers.
They are very good, even though one of our callers who mentioned offline, you were making fun of the psychotic guy who raises his hands.
Yeah, I was just talking about myself.
Yeah, he meant that really, dedicated student by psychotic. I don't think he actually meant anything having to do with actual psychoses.
No.
But if you've got a question or comment or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.